Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. Welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining us in a few minutes will be my good friend and colleague, the wonderful, the wild, the wacky, Bridget Johnson of PJ Media, the Washington editor there. Bridget, we're going to all talk about what's going on in Washington. In fact, yeah, let me tell you something. I'll make a confession here. There's nothing going on really, really big in the world. Not in the world, but at least in Washington. Lots of little stuff, you know. And I figured, when in doubt, have somebody on who can really, really bash Republicans. And who better to do that than my good friend from the blog, Outside the Beltway, Doug Maticonis. Doug, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Rick. How are you doing? It's been a couple months at least since I've been on the show, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, actually, Republicans haven't done anything really outrageous in a couple of months, which is why I haven't had yet. But now we got some good stuff going on with the gays. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago. About the Mexicans, gays, and what was it? Mexicans, lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! It was
right.
Mexicans, gays, and something. Oh my! Anyway, the Republican Party, and let's even narrow that down a little bit. Conservatives have a real, real problem with gay people, don't they?
Well, I mean, I would even narrow it down even further. I would say, I mean, it's really that social conservative evangelical wing of the party where the feelings, I think, are the strongest. I would say that we are at the point now where there are a lot of Republicans and a lot of more economically inclined conservatives who, when it comes to this issue, pretty much, I get the impression, would just rather think, can we just get it over with at this point? That's just as a preliminary point. So I don't know that it's not every Republican, but it's certainly that vocal part of the party that still has a big issue with, gay people in general, same-sex marriage in particular, but also a whole host of other issues that go with it, ranging to everything from whether or not there should be, whether employment discrimination laws should apply to sexual orientation, to gay adoptions, and all this other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And it's born out of a shocking, shocking ignorance. As you highlighted today on your Facebook posting of that nutcase James Dobson, who thinks that bisexual means orgies.
Yeah. I posted that mostly, stuff like that just makes me laugh at this point. But, as you may have seen, I think over the weekend I posted something else and I said, my reaction at this point to a lot of the people that are making these arguments, and not all of them, I think, there's even though I disagree with them, there are actually some people on the opposite side of this issue that actually can form a coherent argument, even though I think they're wrong. But most of them, they're just flailing at this point. They don't really have anything left. And as I've been saying for the better part of a year now, they're basically fighting what I would call a rearguard action. They know they're in retreat. They know they're going to lose this eventually, probably by June, for all intents and purposes. And and to some extent, you know, they've moved on now to the whole religious liberty debate, you know, that we saw manifest in Indiana last month, and you know, which is going to last for quite a long time, I would think. But you know, I mean, right now, what you're seeing a lot of, from people like that is a lot of, you know, it really does sound like panic, because they're just coming up with these really bizarre arguments. You know, like apparently somebody filed one of the amicus briefs that was filed with the Supreme Court and basically made the argument that legalizing gay marriage would lead to at least 1 million more abortions a year.
Oh, you know, okay. Well, we have to do something here that you might not want to do, but that we have to do based solely on the fact that not only the small number, 15-20% of the population, whatever they are, of evangelical Christians oppose gay marriage. This is
right.
Not a fringe issue, which is why then we have to separate the issue of gay marriage from other issues relating to gay civil rights. Okay, I really think we have to do that, because, you know, every poll you see, at least 45% of the American people do not support gay marriage. I mean, and the left and gay activists are making out like anybody who opposes gay marriage is on the fringe. Well, that's bogus. That's a bogus argument.
It is. There's still a close division. I mean, I will make this point that, at least according to the Gallup poll on this on the issue, there wasn't majority support for interracial marriage until sometime in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So,
well,
you know,
can we get away from the race?
Here, let me just, I'm not trying to make the parallel, but the point I'm making is, you know what, it was only 15 years ago where the polling was, what, 75-80% of the population opposed same-sex marriage. You know, now we're at the point where, depending on what point you look at, it's 52-55% support it. That is a big shift in public opinion in a very short period of time. And, you know, and I think what it does is it actually has an impact on both sides of the argument, because on the side that has lost support, it causes them to become defensive and probably more extreme in their rhetoric. On the side where, you know, the argument seems to be shifting and probably is only, you know, and probably is going to stay that way, you know, well into the future, it creates a little bit of, I would say, arrogance and perhaps lack of understanding. You know, I mean, you know, as I try to tell people sometimes, you know, it wasn't that long ago that pretty much everyone opposed same-sex marriage. So maybe you want to dial it back a little bit when you call the people who still oppose it now bigots and all that other stuff. You know,
yeah.
I mean, because I don't
think
you're necessarily... You're not winning any friends when you make that argument.
No. But there's a clear-cut reason in my mind why this titanic shift, a cultural tsunami has occurred. And it has nothing to do with any court cases or anything the gay activists have done. It is the fact that there are so many gay people now. It's more accepted. And not only that, because it's accepted, gays are coming out of the closet. They're coming out of the closet to their families, to their friends, to their relatives,
right,
to their people at work. As more and more Americans know, you know, a gay person, they realize how stupid it was to oppose gay marriage and
right.
gay civil
no,
rights
I,
for
right.
that matter. Although that's lagging a little bit, but still.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Is that, I mean, I think that's almost true about when you're dealing with any type of issue like this. Is, you know, it's a lot easier to hold negative opinions about an entire group of people when you don't interact with them on a daily basis. But
yes.
Once you start interacting with them, or in this case, you know, they're literally your family members, which has happened to a couple members of Congress, on the Republican side. I mean, what's his name from Ohio? Name escapes me right now. The Republican senator from Ohio.
Dick Cheney,
Dick Cheney, obvious, as an obvious choice. Rob Portman, when he made his statement 2 or 3 years ago, I mean, he said one of the things, he basically admitted one of the primary things that influenced him changing his mind was the fact that his son came out. So, that's just human nature, I think.
Exactly. And that's the way cultural changes have to be made. They're not going to be legislated. They're not going to be adjudicated from the court. Cultural changes are made one person at a time. You can talk all you want to about the Civil Rights Act of 1965. But it wasn't until African-Americans actually got into the workforce and into neighborhoods that they were previously denied. And people started to get to know black people. That support picked up for stuff like interracial marriage. And now, of course, the voting rights, you have, 90% of the people think blacks should have the same voting rights as whites. So cultural changes like that need to come slowly. It's an evolution, not a revolution. And take one more issue, Doug, abortion. Now, the interesting thing about abortion is that if you ask people, are you in favor of abortion to save the life of a mother or in case of rape or incest, the numbers are like 85%, yes.
Right.
But if you say abortion should be legal on demand at any time till the 26th week or whatever it is, whether it's the second trimester, you get a hell of a lot different response, and barely a plurality support that position.
That issue is one where the nation has almost been divided 50-50 for the last 40 years, and it's probably going to continue to be the case for a very long time.
Yeah, as long as the religious strictures, and I sense the religious strictures becoming less and less important as far as the gay rights are concerned, but as far as abortion is concerned, that will probably never change, because even mainline Protestant churches oppose abortion of that kind, abortion on demand.
I don't necessarily think that religion is even the only thing that motivates people's opinions on that issue, because even whether you're religious or not, if somebody's pregnant, I mean, that's usually supposed to be a good thing. So, the whole. I mean, the whole idea of ending it, even if you believe that, at some point in the pregnancy that right should be relatively unrestricted, I mean, I don't know anyone, other than, the idiot radicals on the pro-choice side that don't do themselves any favors, who think that, it's ever a good thing that someone had an abortion. I mean, it's like... it's like saying it's a good thing that somebody had cancer. I mean, it's something that happened. Somebody made a choice. They had the right to make it, but, we could get into a whole long discussion of, birth control and sex education as it relates to abortion, but that's a whole other issue.
No, it's part of the same pattern, and, we're in our Republican bashing mode or conservative bashing mode, and it's easy to do when you have the Republican Party to this day, or at least the 2012 platform, not making exceptions for rape or incest in abortion.
Yeah.
That's nuts. That's about 7% of the population and only about 15% of Republicans. But if you ask... look at the problems that Republican politicians get into when they talk about abortion and rape.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's just, it's painful to watch these guys squirm because they don't want to offend the 15% of the base that would, that would probably vote against them if they said what was really true, It's a conundrum.
It's a conundrum, and I mean, I don't know if there's any easy solution to it. I mean, I think to get back to the original question, as far as the GOP platform in 2016 goes, I think the abortion part of it, you know, it's going to stay the way it is. I think especially depending on how the Supreme Court goes, and I think, I don't know, again, I'm reluctant to predict things, but that seems pretty obvious right now. I mean, there's going to be,
well, does it?
I think,
I mean, I thought the Supreme Court, correct me if I'm wrong, the Supreme Court is always reluctant to overturn established laws. And, you know, they like to do things piecemeal.
And some would argue, I mean, you could argue that they actually have been doing things piecemeal as far as the gay rights issues go, starting all the way back in 1998 with a case called Romer versus Evans, and
and
Lawrence v. Texas and U.S. v. Windsor. We could get into it at some point if you wanted to, but there's a whole set of reasons why the way things have gone since October on this issue with the Supreme Court, I would be exceedingly shocked if we didn't end up with a decision striking down the laws in the remaining 13 states that still ban same-sex marriage.
That's a real possibility. We'll have to look for that. Joining us now, all the way from Washington, D.C., if I could get her to come on. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Bridget, can you hear me? I've got Bridget Johnson, but I'm clicking and nothing's happening. Nothing is happening. Bridget, could you hang up and call in again, please? See if that will work, because right now I'm not getting anything from you. You can hear me, right, Doug?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Well, she can hear me. She just hung up. She's going to call back in.
That is weird. Okay.
Usually you have to click on the little microphone icon, and voila, you get something. Oh, wait a minute. Are you on?
Me? I'm here, Rick.
Okay, because you're not showing up on
Oh, no,
wait a minute. There you are.
Yeah, okay. Isn't technology great?
I'm sorry, Bridget, I can't get you to come on. I don't know what the hell the problem is. Hang on a second. Shoot. What to do? No, it says hold to listen. Okay. I think it's in listen only mode. Okay. What am I doing? Let me go here. Okay. Now I'm muted. Bridget, can you hear me now? Doug, can you hear me? Doug? There's Doug, right? Okay, now I got you. Bridget, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right. I don't know what the hell the problem was. That was bizarre. Well,
Did you lose Doug?
Blog Talk Radio. Yeah, well, I was clicking on your telephone number here to get you on, and the little icon, the icon that says you're on, was saying you weren't on. So, anyway, you're on now. How are you doing? Bridget Johnson, Washington editor at PJ Media, and a frequent guest on this show, as well as co-host. So how you doing, Bridget?
Well, D.C. is lovely this time of year. What can I say?
Yes, it is. I miss it. You know, I used to drive down Massachusetts Avenue, Embassy Row, because all of that beautiful foliage and flowering plants, like the dogwood and the azaleas, I mean, I used to say it was like driving through a Walt Disney cartoon. The Technicolor was just extraordinary. It was just great. And, of course,
the only problem, Rick, is you have to deal with the D.C. drivers when you're doing that. So
Traffic circles.
Pecan circle.
Always got me. I was
this
terrified.
This is why ever since I moved to Virginia, I keep moving further west.
You don't have to deal with it, yeah. Except beltway traffic, which is always fun, I guess.
Yeah.
Tourist buses are the worst.
So, Bridget, I'm going to give you a chance to weigh in on this We've been discussing the Republican, or actually conservative, opposition to all things gay. Everything's gay. And especially, I don't know if you saw this, Pat Dobson, who's a group, and the American Family, something, whatever it is, they actually published a study, scientific study, a couple of years ago, saying that the vast majority of homosexual men are actually pedophiles, which somehow made its way through the conservative echo chamber. And now you can't, you know, anything you write about gays on any website, anywhere on the conservative blogosphere, you're going to find people coming up and quoting that study saying that, well, of course, gay men are pedophiles. But Dobson thinks that he said, think about LGBT. He says the B stands for bisexual. That's orgies.
Is he making an observation or a wish?
Yeah. That's a different issue. This idea that some of these people are so fearful of gays, you have to wonder if they have a little, you know, attraction to the same sex in their own lives going on somewhere. But anyway.
I know. I have never heard my gay friends talk about sodomy as much as people on conservative websites do.
That's true.
I'm sorry, but my gay friends are talking about normal things like, you know, decorating their living room or, you know, going to a concert or how their job's going or something like that. But people who are so opposed to gays in any shape or form, they talk about gay sex way more than gays do.
Right. Anyway. I made the point a little earlier. I'd like you to comment on it. That the reason there is this this cultural tsunami, where just as many as recently as 2008, when President Obama said he was against gay marriage, you know, the numbers were about 70-75% against gay marriage. Well, now it's 55% in support of gay marriage, and the point I tried to make, and Doug agrees with, is that the reason is that so many gay people have come out to their families, their friends, their relatives, their coworkers. Everybody now knows a gay person or two or five. And guess what? They ain't so scary. People wonder what the big hubbub was about, you know, as far as preventing gay marriage. So that's the way the cultural changes actually should occur, person by person, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, so forth. And that's a very conservative position to have. Well, what do you think?
Well, and people also see that one of the key arguments that social conservatives have made, that it's going to, you know, make heterosexual marriage, you know, completely disintegrate, doesn't wash either, because, you know, everybody knows broken marriages in their lives. Everybody knows heterosexual broken marriages in their lives. And, you know, it wasn't like some sneaky gay person was in the corner, you know, coming in and breaking up their marriage. So it's a combination, I think, of just, you know, more people coming out of the closet, just kind of, you know, seamlessly integrating into people's everyday lives. People like, you know, Senator Rob Portman, his son, you know, changed his position on gay marriage. You know, and a combination of, you know, it's been many years, and these same arguments that are being used by groups like James Dobson's just aren't washing. They just aren't holding.
Yeah. And of course, there is. It's not a question really of so many people opposing gay marriage, because there's still a sizable segment of the population that doesn't want gay marriage. I mean, 40-45%, depending on the poll you look at. So it's not a fringe issue, but it's still an issue that where the gay activists are their own worst enemies, in my opinion, in that they have eschewed state legislatures and have gone to federal court to get their desires fulfilled, which, I, you know, there's nothing really wrong with it, but it wouldn't have been a lot better if state by state hearts and minds would have been changed, even in a place like Mississippi or Alabama. I mean, yeah, it might take 10, 15 years, but the change wouldn't be so wrenching and so fraught with where people would fear it.
Well, you know, Rick, let me pipe in about that real quick, because I'm just going to be the lawyer in the group, and I'm going to say, you know, I understand your argument about, you know, the legislatures versus the courts and all that other good stuff, but, you know, number one, you know, state legislatures are hardly paragons of virtue in this country, especially in places like Alabama and Mississippi.
Okay.
But, you know, that's another story. And secondly, you know, for better or worse, you know, this is what the courts are supposed to be for. And, you know, they're doing, the way I look at it is the courts, the judges are doing their jobs. And ultimately, you know, it's going to be up, you know, starting actually a week from today, less than a week from today, actually, given that it'll be in the morning on Tuesday. You know, it'll start with the arguments before the nine justices of the Supreme Court to decide what happens to that issue. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of how the system's going to work, or is supposed to work. And, you know, I mean, I've never been one of these kinds of people who bought into the arguments of people like Robert Bork about how the courts should not overstep majority opinion. I mean, I think, to a large degree, the courts exist to protect the minority. So I'm just going to throw that out there. That's just me.
Yeah, that's fine. Bridget, what do you think? State legislature versus the courts?
I mean, I'm more inclined to agree with Doug there, and you know, and I have to kind of say too that I think the whole notion of the gay mafia gets kind of overblown. You know, I mean, obviously the gay mafia would be fashionably impeccably dressed, and you know,
I'm picturing a new version of the Godfather with the gay mafia now.
all in Lagerfeld suits, you know. And,
exactly.
And but
Michael,
you know, it, for
Michael
for example,
Corleone.
You have somebody like Marco Rubio, you know,
with a cigarette. Michael Corleone with a cigarette holder. Yeah. Okay. There. I'm sorry. I had to get that in. That's funny, Michael Corleone with a cigarette holder. That's got to be there. Okay, go ahead. You were saying Michael
and a very
Michael
jaunty
Rubio?
Kerchief, yes.
Yes, of course.
But okay, so you have Marco Rubio, and he was asked, you know, would you go to a gay wedding? And his answer, you know, if it was somebody I loved, it was one of my staffers, you know, something like that, and I wanted to show my love and support for them, yes, you know, I still personally oppose it. You know, notice he didn't get pilloried by, you know, the gay mafia for his answer, because, you know, he was saying, I personally oppose it, but I would try to show some love and compassion. And I think if answers like that came from the right a lot more, then you'd see a lot fewer people being jumped on and a lot, you know, less of the impression that there's a gay mafia that jumps on everybody.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that brings up an interesting point that we don't hear discussed often enough, but that I think it was Rand Paul who demonstrated the point perfectly. Democrats don't get asked questions like that. Only Republicans. They never asked, and was it Rand Paul who said they never asked Democrats about killing a 7-pound baby in a late-term abortion? I don't think they ever asked Democrats questions like that. And I guess when they asked Pelosi, some intrepid reporter asked Pelosi that question, she fumbled it as good as any Republican fumbles the abortion rape question. So what is there anything that Republicans especially can do to, you know, kind of shame the press into asking questions like that, uncomfortable questions on cultural issues that perhaps the Democrats would have a hard time answering? Is there anything Republicans can do to change the atmosphere to make reporters do that?
Well, you know, I would suggest that, you know, not everybody gets fielded with questions like that. If you know, some of these reporters, you know, weren't thinking that they were going to get a jackpot answer off of it. You know, it's like
right.
you take a question like that and you go to somebody like Rick Santorum, you know, it's just going to be standby gold rolling out of his mouth. You know, but you know if you sit down with John Kasich and, you know, start asking him questions about socially conservative questions, you're just going to kind of be engrossed in, you know, what he actually has to say and, you know, not just doing it for the soundbite value. So I think it has a lot to do with the reputation of the politician who's being asked.
Yeah.
I agree.
Except I saw 8 Republican presidential candidates in a debate in 2012 raise their hand when asked about evolution, whether they believed in it, if they didn't believe in it. 8 Republican candidates for president of the United States said they didn't believe in evolution. You know,
it's a dumb question, but here's what the smart politician would say. You know, it doesn't matter what I believe. I mean, the question, I mean, you know, and I've had some strong opinions on that issue for a long time, but my opinions aren't about what someone believes. They're about what do you want, are you going to mandate something that isn't really science being taught in science classrooms? That's the only question.
Exactly.
That's the only question I care about. That's the only one anyone should care about with a politician. And when it comes to the president of the United States, I'm not even sure why it's a relevant question.
Right. Well, we just,
you know, when was the last time the president decided curriculum standards?
Exactly. Except, you know, we had a blog published on American Thinker a couple of days ago, making the claim that of course all the races could have come from Adam and Eve. I mean, you're talking about recessive genes here, so of course all the races could have come from
This is why I don't get into those discussions anymore. But you know. I mean, I've worked on long ago in a galaxy far, far away, I worked on political campaigns. I mean, I was never in the top advisor position or anything, but, I mean, you know, there are ways politicians can answer questions. There are ways they can refuse to answer questions. And then there's the other way, which is the Chris Christie way, which is just to say, that is a ridiculous question and I'm not going to answer it. and I will honestly tell you, I honestly think for a lot of these things, whether it's on the cultural crap or on some of those debate questions, I remember one CNN debate, they were asking questions like Coke or Pepsi and stupid stuff like that. If someone had stood up in that debate and said, I'm running for president of the United States, I'm not here to talk about soda, that, you know, that would have actually impressed me a little bit, but you know they all went along with it. You know, it was all kind of stupid. It was stupid little fun. You know, still, I mean, the media, you know, in general. I don't really care what network you're talking about at this point. They love to focus on the trivial stuff, and this is all trivial stuff. So.
Well, let's get away from the trivial stuff and talk about some important things. Bridget, looks like they're going to have a vote on Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General designate, sometime maybe as soon as tomorrow, although probably not until Thursday, because they actually made a deal on the human trafficking bill, abortion restrictions, that apparently is going to allow some non-abortion loving entities to take care of the trafficked people, which that's just great, isn't it? I mean, somebody really wants to take care of these people, and the reason that Congress won't let them is because they're for abortion. Well, anyway, what does this mean? As far as the Congress is concerned, I mean, is the Republican Congress doing a better job of running Congress than the Democrats did?
Well, I can say that Mitch McConnell came out after the GOP policy luncheon today And he basically declared that Democrats love his Senate even more than they loved Harry Reid's Senate. And the reason being because the Republicans are actually allowing roll call votes on amendments, whereas Harry Reid used to try to fill the tree and, you know, not allow any GOP amendments to come to the floor, even though he didn't allow a lot of Democratic amendments to come to the floor as well. So I think it's been Reid allowed 15 roll call votes on amendments last year, and so far this year McConnell has allowed about 100. So he's, kind of running a victory lap at this point and saying, you know, I'm letting people have their bills. I'm letting them be open up for amendments. You're probably going to see a lot of amendments come forth when the Iran bill comes to the floor, which in addition to Loretta Lynch is one of the things they want to take care of before Memorial Day.
Yeah.
I think that the Republicans think that they've really instituted a different dynamic. McConnell says he's had some Senate Democrats come up to him and thank him because they're so happy and ecstatic that they can now get votes.
Well,
Chuck Schumer had a different point of view today. He said that McConnell's learning a lesson. When he divides us, he fails. But
well, you know, I don't want to interrupt, not to interrupt Bridget, but I will say, what was today? Joe Manchin, who, of course, just recently announced that he's staying in the Senate instead of going back home, he publicly said what you just were saying McConnell was saying Democrats have said to him privately, which is that McConnell's been doing a better job running the Senate, which I thought was hilarious. You know, I mean, obviously, Joe Manchin is probably the most quote-unquote conservative member of the Democratic caucus.
Yeah,
whatever you want to call it. But, you know, he's probably closer to the Republican caucus on some things than others, but, you know, than any other Democrat. But still, I thought that was really interesting. It was a little swipe that I thought was in. Although then I said to myself when I read it, I said, yeah, he's not going to like Chuck Schumer much either. But, you know.
I think
Schumer
will actually be easier with some of the members because I think that Democrats kind of saw Reid going off the deep end a little bit there. I'm trying to be nice and polite about his age, but let's face it, he has said some things that, you know, your uncle would embarrassingly say at a Thanksgiving dinner that, you know, members don't really want to be hearing from their majority leader. So I think that at least having Schumer come in, they feel that things are maybe going to get a little bit more grounded in their caucus.
Well, obviously McConnell wouldn't bring the Lynch nomination to the floor unless there were 60 votes to get it done. So there are five Republicans at least, aren't there? There are five Republicans who have announced publicly that they are going to vote for her confirmation. You know, I'm really old-fashioned here because I just don't see why this very qualified, extremely qualified, experienced woman shouldn't, you know, sail through with 87, 90, 95 votes. I mean, how can you oppose somebody like this? Just because she thinks, you know, a little differently than politically than others, that doesn't mean she can't do a good job as Attorney General, because most of what happens is, for an Attorney General has nothing to do with politics. It's all about administering the Department of Justice. And, you know, and it used to be, Bridget, and again, here I am, old-fashioned curmudgeon, it used to be the president sent a nomination up to the Hill, and unless the person was a closet case klepto Klansman, they approved, you know, they just sailed through. What is the problem with Loretta Lynch as far as the vast majority of Republicans are concerned?
Well, besides three senators running for president. I mean, Loretta Lynch figured prominently into Ted Cruz's speech in New Hampshire last weekend. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of the, you know, lawmakers who are kind of, you know, making these symbolic statements and saying, you know, why they won't vote for her, They asked her questions to which she replied, "I'll have to study that further," or "I'll actually have to see that when it comes to my desk," or something like that. And then they came out and said, you know, "She won't support this. She won't, you know, do this," when she was trying to give.
And Bridget, the other part of the, when I was watching the hearing, I watched part of the hearings was, you know, the one thing, and I've seen several bloggers point this out, and a couple senators, I believe, have mentioned it in speeches. You know, I think at one point she was asked about, you know, the president's, you know, executive action immigration thing in, from November. And, you know, she said that in her opinion, she thought it was legal, appropriate, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, of course, every, you know, but, you know, my response to that is, you know, I'm really surprised that the president would appoint someone who agreed with him.
Right. Holy smokes. Shocker.
You know,
shocker.
I mean, I agree with Rick, basically. I think, you know, especially for cabinet positions, especially, you know, the group of people that are basically the president's deputies and advisors in running the executive branch, he should basically be able to get whoever he wants unless they're clearly not qualified or unless there's some kind of something in their history that would really cause someone to doubt their judgment. You know, I mean, the most recent example of that I can think of is from the first Bush administration. I'm thinking John Tower. Oh. Remember the John Tower nomination?
Oh, yes. Defense
and
Secretary,
the whole, he was nominated for Defense Secretary, former senator from Texas. You know, in terms of his qualifications, he was qualified, but, you know, he had a bit of an alcohol problem, you know, and I'll honestly say, you know, I mean, for the United States Senate to actually reject one of its own former members, which they would have done if he hadn't withdrawn, you know, would have been pretty extraordinary. That hasn't happened in a very long time. But, you know, other than something like that for a cabinet member, you know, I mean, I think there has to be some deference. You know, when you're talking about judges, you know, especially at the appellate level, definitely the Supreme Court level, completely different story. But, for cabinet members, I mean, come on. You know, I mean, you know, I
well,
saw one
per. Well, Obama has had 2 cabinet meetings in 6 years or something.
Right.
I mean, seriously, not to say he hasn't talked to these people, but even there, he's called the Interior Secretary twice during his entire tenure there, for God's sake.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
and of course, there's the old story about, you know, Reagan's HUD secretary walking down the hall of the White House at one point and the president saying, "Who is that guy?" But, you know, I mean, you know, the cabinet, you know, the cabinet doesn't necessarily mean what it used to, especially, you know, like not in Lincoln's day or certainly not in President Washington's day when you had, you know, Jefferson and Hamilton arguing across the table with each other. But, you know, still, you know, these are supposed to be his deputies, basically. And whether he talks to them directly or his staff is the one who talks to him, it's basically the same thing. So, you know, that's my opinion. I think personally, I know, I mean, from what I know of her record in as U.S. attorney in New York, you know, on things like civil asset forfeiture and stuff like that, I don't like it, but, you know, she was following the law when she was doing it. So if you don't like what she did, you need to change the law and not, you know, take it out on her. That's my opinion,
right.
Anyway.
Exactly. Well, we could.
Yeah, I really felt that after she was nominated, people were really stretching to try and kind of come up with something of why they didn't like her, why they wanted Eric Holder to stay over her.
That was the worst part, yeah. Yes, let's keep Eric Holder in office longer, yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's move on. Want to talk a little bit about the Hillary, the book coming out on Hillary that will detail. It has detailed, according to the New York Times, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars that have been given by foreign governments to the Clinton Foundation. And what makes this problematic is that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, and there appears to be a connection between the money going in and favors from the Department of State going out to these same countries, which you know, you could probably make a connection. I read that. I sent that article around from the Plumline, Greg Sargent. You can probably make a connection between just about anything these days if you look hard enough, and if you're biased enough in your approach. And I
right.
didn't sense that this fella is very nonpartisan and certainly hardly objective. So I'm just curious. I'll probably read the book but what do you think, Bridget? Do you think there's a lot of smoke there, but do you think there's any fire?
You know, I mean, I've done one piece about, a questionable State Department move in relation to donations, and that was with something that Senator Vitter raised about the delayed designation of Boko Haram as a terrorist organization, and was that connected to the fact that a huge Nigerian developer is a big donor to the Clinton Foundation, a longtime friend of the Clintons, and at the time he was doing some development projects and, you know, trying to lure, you know, more high-end real estate and you know, industry to Nigeria. After I did that piece, of course, I got very, very jumped on by that that specific donor's allies. They did not want even a hint of that association out there. But, you know, these are questions that are going to be asked. You know, when you're Secretary of State for that long, you know, you're going to have a trail. Well, I should say only so much of a trail if you get rid of your emails. But the Clintons have such a long history that it's kind of a double-edged sword for Hillary. On one hand, so much of her history is already out there, so fine, you know, no big deal. If people haven't been troubled by the scandal so far, they're not going to be troubled by it in the future. On the other hand, she's been around for so long that, you know, there are the potential for other skeletons to be dug up there. And I think that her campaign is confident, I can say, that nothing that's so important is going to come up as to derail her candidacy. But you even kind of have the people who are nipping at her heels, such as Jim Webb, starting to talk about where's the money coming from.
Yeah.
Well,
that raises an interesting question, Bridget. Why aren't other prominent Democrats jumping in now that it appears, at least, Hillary is vulnerable? I mean, Republicans are catching up to her in the polls. There are a lot of important state polls that show Republicans right there or ahead of her. Why aren't there prominent Democrats, making noises about running? She has an open field, except for Martin O'Malley and Jim Webb. I mean, come on.
I think that they're checking their donor lists and their tallies and trying to figure out how they come up with $2.5 billion.
Uh-huh,
it's really daunting for, you know, a Democrat who wants to jump in at this point. Now, I think that a Democrat who does decide to challenge the Clinton machine will get brownie points just for that and be able to milk some votes off of that. But, you know, you even have, you know, John Podesta, her campaign CEO, I'm just going to call him Don Podesta for the rest of the campaign because he's like a mafia Don.
Yeah.
He came to Congress today. He came right into the Senate closed-door policy luncheon with the Democrats and, quote-unquote, introduced them to the Hillary campaign.
Oh,
so this is starting early. It will be often, and Podesta has made clear that they want a tight operation and they want disciplined, targeted hits. And that's definitely going to include trying to discourage viable challengers.
Yeah.
Well,
so it appears
what,
that they're going to have
okay,
to...
Okay, well, let me throw that question, this question out there. What viable challengers?
Cuomo.
Good question.
Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo. Well, first of all, he's got enough issues to deal with in Albany right now.
Yeah, he does.
The Speaker of the Assembly is under indictment. There's already allegations that the Senate President could be next. I mean, no, and Andrew Cuomo has enough problems already. And as I said 2-3 years ago, the only way you would know that Andrew Cuomo was going to run for president is if he got married, and he didn't. So, you know, he's not going to run as a bachelor. He's just not going to, because, you know, he's not going to want to be compared to James Buchanan. But,
no. So what was it? Robert Taft was a bachelor, wasn't he? Was it Taft?
I don't.
Taft, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I don't. Well, you know, I'm talking people who actually got elected president, but you know, I mean, you know.
Well, how about President Howard Taft?
William Howard Taft. I'm pretty sure William Howard Taft was not a bachelor. Yeah.
Okay. Somebody around that.
But
time
in any
was. Anyway.
He was just a very large man, but that's a completely different issue.
Yes. Where were we?
But,
sorry to throw you off there.
I think along the lines, though, of keep your enemies closer, the Clintons have been meeting with Julian Castro since August, and I think that they're not even going into this election without a full ticket planned. I think that, you know, once he came out at the last DNC and was that everybody's like, oh, rising star, oh, breath of fresh air, wasn't he wonderful? That kind of clued the Clintons in to kind of keep him close so that he didn't break out on his own and decide he wanted to do a Marco Rubio-style campaign this time. So I think that he will probably be on heading a ticket sometime in the future, but I think that this time he might be Hillary's number two.
He might be number two. I still think that, I will honestly tell you that up until November, I thought that the leading candidate to be Hillary's number two was going to be Mark Warner, but after he barely won re-election, that's not going to happen. Some people I know in Virginia are keep mentioning Tim Kaine's name, but I don't know. He's not the most exciting politician on the planet. I don't see that happening.
I think the Clintons hate Tim Kaine, don't they, Bridget? Aren't they?
I know Obama does ever since the Ron thing started.
Oh, okay. Well, that probably means the Clintons love him then. Yeah. Well, it's an oddity in American politics to have this kind of a dominant candidate, before the race even begins. Hillary was not this dominant in 2008, even though, you know, there were she had several challengers, and Barack Obama was thought to be, a legitimate challenger the day he announced, as I recall. So,
he was polling far better than anyone, including people who are obviously not going to run, like Elizabeth Warren, is polling against Hillary Clinton right now. I mean, that's just, that's why whenever anyone makes the 2008 analogy in terms of, oh, don't count, don't assume Hillary is going to be the nominee, it's possible she could mess up and the Democrats could end up with Jim Webb, which would be really entertaining. But, this is not 2008. This is totally different. They have. I think they really have learned. I mean, from what Bridget was saying about, Podesta meeting with Senate Democrats today, and things like the fact that a lot of the people that were part of the Obama 2008 campaign are now part of the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Yeah.
This is going to be a very. This is going to be. In my opinion, what was it? 2008, the Republican race was effectively over in February after CPAC when Mitt Romney dropped out. I think basically that's what's going to happen. I mean, although the primaries apparently are going to start later in 2016, I hope. And in any, but I think that's effectively what's going to happen with the Democrats. After you get past Iowa New Hampshire, you know, maybe South Carolina. I mean, that's going to be the end of it. And there's not going to be, you know, I mean, you know, maybe somebody. I personally, the one person I would like to see get in the race just because I think he would be fun to watch would be Brian Schweitzer, just because he tends to spout off on the stump and say things that, you know, nobody else would say.
Well, he had that interview in the Washington Monthly last year that disqualified him. I mean, he said some really outrageous, ignorant things, and I'm trying to recall what he exactly. What he said.
Oh no, I know
the
interview.
They were saying that at that time that this pretty much ended his presidential ambitions because he's just incredible. Just quote after quote after quote of inanity. I mean, it was just horrible. But Schweitzer,
I would
yeah.
love the Bernie Sanders Hillary Clinton debate. I would love that.
Oh yeah, or Elizabeth Warren. Although Bernie's even a little farther left than she is. Although that's hard to do, I know. But Bernie is an out-and-out socialist. I mean, he wants to
Bernie
nationalize the banks.
Bernie just walks in there like Doc Brown from Back to the Future,
you know,
and goes for it.
Let's not forget that Bernie Sanders would actually have to join the Democratic Party to run for the nomination.
That's true. One last issue I'd like to throw. We've got about 5 minutes left. The fast track free trade bill. Is this going to trip Hillary up? I mean, she has yet to really come out and say where she stands on it, Bridget. And, of course, if she says she supports it, the labor unions will go gaga. And if she says she opposes it, she'll have half the Democratic Senate opposed to her. So, you know, has she actually come out and said where she stands on the fast track issue?
Well, I know Harry Reid was very vocal on that today with us up on the Hill. He basically said he'd rather lie in front of a moving train than, you know, and then support it. But no, I don't know exactly where she's going to go on this. You know, John Podesta, he's kind of like, yeah, I know you people are badgering me for a platform, but, you know, that'll eventually come. So just pull on your horses.
So punch. When in doubt, punch.
Rick, let me answer your question about where Hillary is going to stand on this issue or pretty much anything. Like, all you need to do is take one of your fingers, lick it, and hold it up to the wind.
Yeah, right. She'll say
that her position came out of her pre-planned town hall sit down with six previously chosen people in Iowa. And that's where her grassroots all-American opinion came from.
Right. Not more than 500 people in the country understand what the fast track legislation is. So anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So here you are. One last question for you, Bridget, and it has to do with Hillary again. How many women, and maybe give me a percent, are going to vote for her because she's a woman?
You know, I think that's overblown. I really do. Sorry, but we're a bit smarter than that. I think that Republicans saying that women are just going to vote for her because she's a woman tends to piss off some women. they you know, might be more friendly towards the Democratic side. I think especially if you get somebody like, okay, say, you know, I know everybody on our comment section thinks that Jeb Bush is the Antichrist, but if his wife was out on the campaign trail, you would see probably a lot of Latino women coming over and voting for the ticket, not just because someone is one gender or another, but because they feel that they can relate to her and that they can relate to her story. And know that she knows what they're going through, et cetera. So I think it's going to be more about relatability than gender.
Well, I sure hope so, because that would be a travesty of elections if that were to happen. At any rate, we are at the end of our hour, and it's been an enjoyable discussion for both of you. Todd, you even convinced me of a few things.
Oh, well, oh my gosh, that stops presses. I'm aghast, yes. Oh, Lord.
Aghast.
Of going to a gay wedding, or what?
Yeah.
Well, because they would be fabulous.
Because it'd be totally
fabulous.
I came
out in favor of gay marriage in 2010, so do not talk to me about my topic.
Our readers know that you did, trust me.
I'm sure they do.
Never
anyway,
read the comments. Never read the comments.
Yeah, I try not to. I know when I'm going to get lambasted, so I don't do it anymore. Anyway, Bridget, I want to thank you for filling in for Rod Cackley, who will join us at some point in the future to talk about some cultural issues, I'm sure, because Rod is very much active in that department. But Bridget,
our illustrious State House reporter, yes.
Yes. Very, very nice of you to join us on short notice, and I really appreciate it.
No problem. Good time.
And my co-host, Doug Matakanis. Doug, I'll wait another couple of months, and then we'll bash Republicans together.
Oh, I'm sure there will be something, Rick. There will be some reason we
absolutely.
Can talk again.
Absolutely. So thanks for joining me, Doug. And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.